Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 356.AC1919, certificate number 25815, Disco Demolition Night.
There may be more than records flying. Kids are running around. I don't see how the security guards really can do anything but apprehend a kid or two and take them out. They're trying to rescue the batting cage now out in Short Center.
So, John, you and I have spent considerable time educating the far future about the importance of world's fairs and expos, one of our favorite things. This is the first time, though, we have actually performed our historical duty on an actual world's fair ground.
That's right. A world's fair that I would like to add on a personal note was the idea of my great uncle Al.
Your Uncle Al thought of the 1962 Seattle.
Thank you. Yeah, a big applause for Uncle Al.
It appears like Al is here in the crowd.
Al's been dead for 30 years, but Al was a Seattle City Councilman in the 1940s and 50s. And I think you can find this in the historic record. Al Rochester had the spark of inspiration that brought the World's Fair.
Do you know what happened? A Space Needle fell on his head?
He died of old age.
What killed him? What gave him the idea?
Oh, what gave him the idea?
I'm pretty sure he did not die from the Space Needle falling on his head. I would have seen it in the papers.
This was back in the day when Seattle City Council people were like, "Let's go Seattle," instead of now.
What do they say now?
Now they're like, "Seattle, into the ocean."
that was your campaign slogan.
That was my campaign slogan, yeah.
Yeah, we're here in the Seattle Center at the Bumbershoot Music Festival.
That's right.
Seattle audience. Is anyone a fan of our American League Baseball team, the Seattle Mariners? Very, very mild applause.
Well, let me just say that we're performing in a children's theater to an audience of podcast listeners. You're not really going to get that sports pandering that you're looking for.
Well, also, this is New Seattle. All these people moved here from Austin like in June. They're like, the Mariners, eh? the Mariners, for my lifetime, have just been a constant source of disappointment and pain to me. They're in a crucial, as we record this, and this is the year of our Lord 2018, they're in a crucial series that could determine their pennant race with the A's, but they're 5.5 games back. They lost last night in dispiriting fashion.
Do you remember, in also true Mariners fashion, just a little while ago when it seemed like they couldn't be beat?
Sure. There's a certain kind of Seattleite who moved here in the very early 21st century who thinks of them as a great team in hard times.
Yeah, a great team that just can't quite pull it off.
And that's not true because, you know, your childhood and mine was full of going to the Kingdome, a dispiriting place, and seeing dispiriting losses by the Mariners.
Going to the Kingdome and watching the ceiling fall on unsuspecting people.
Killing people, and then people would go up and try to fix it, and they would die as well. So many deaths in our baseball-loving childhood. For the benefit of the future, baseball is kind of a national pastime for us, which means it kind of generally makes people feel good, especially if you're kind of an older white person.
Baseball
And no one's really that into it, which is like...
Baseball is a sport that transcends race and culture and gender. It is truly America's pastime. And I mean America in all of its melting pot glory.
But no one is all that into it in the same way they might be into it. You know, it's incredibly universally beloved and popular, but no one really likes it. It's like NCIS or something.
What about George Will? You're discounting George Will.
It's true. George Will is the perfect example of a baseball fan in my mind. He might be the youngest one.
We have no We have no idea if future listeners of this show are just like super intelligent baseballs that have like gained intelligence over the millennia.
It seems unlikely.
I mean, you cannot predict the future.
I didn't yes-and your idea. Baseballs are made of horse hide, right? Are they horse ghosts? Or like, could the futurelings be the ghost horses that inhabited their former corpses?
Round ghost horses filled with like rubber.
I used to have legs. The Mariners are currently in the longest playoff drought in all four professional sports. Did you guys know this? When the Buffalo Bills managed to upset their way into the playoffs at the end of last December, that left the Mariners as the longest playoffless team. They have not been in the playoffs since 2001, Ichiro's rookie season, and also that was their record-setting 116-game season. They have come back from that with like 17 straight seasons of no playoff appearance.
Didn't just a minute ago you say that no one cared about baseball?
Yeah, I looked all this up. I'm not a random person on the street planted here and asked to talk about baseball. I spent this morning on Wikipedia and baseballanalytics.com. When I was a kid, the Mariners were in a larger AL West. It was before the 94 realignment. So I would often go to games and see them play the Chicago White Sox.
That's right.
Another lackluster AL West team
My
of our childhoods.
Would take me to the cold, drafty King Dome, and we would sit high up.
Look down at the ungodly green AstroTurf, yeah. Watch people slide all over it and have like lasting knee injuries because of it.
Yeah, and there'd be like a boat show in the outfield.
First time I ever went to the Kingdom was a boat show. Second time was a Sounders game.
I think my first time was a Cub Scout encampment. Or not encampment. That would be weird. No.
But like, put all the Cub Scouts in the stadiums.
Like a big Cub Scout, you know, like a scouting.
A domaree.
Event, yeah. A jamboree, thank you. It was a big old jamboree.
Those are in AstroTurf stadiums?
Not anymore.
They look like parking garages?
They tore all those down. Remember when the citizens of Seattle universally voted to replace the Kingdom?
To implode the Kingdom. Yeah, we all voted for it so many times.
Oh, we voted for it every time they put it on the
And they finally were just like, the people just want us to do this. Let's do it.
No, that's not true.
You have long had a picture in your bathroom of the Kingdom imploding.
Yeah, my mom and I actually...
I believe you told me you cannot urinate unless you're looking at a picture of the... Kingdom imploding. Is that true?
It's like a trigger. Yeah, I'm just like, I'm so frustrated. And then I see the Kingdom destroyed, and I'm like, oh.
Nobody put on that video right now.
No, my mom and I went up to the 12th Avenue Bridge there, and like crack of dawn, I'm sure I was awake through the night, and watched the Kingdom explode and watch that big dusty cloud go over the city. It was a great Seattle moment.
It really does kind of sum up the Mariners' spirit, watching something kind of implode at the last minute.
I mean, I feel like right now the temperature in the city of Seattle would really, I think, would be galvanized around blowing something up downtown.
Yeah, we love big clouds of smoke. That's what I've learned this summer. Like the Mariners, the White Sox kind of had a lackadaisical, a lackluster 70s and 80s, let's say.
They weren't the winningest team.
They weren't even the winningest team in Chicago, a team famous for having a crappy National League team. In 1979... when our story takes place, the White Sox were so lackluster that their big star was one Chet Lemon, a better-than-average center fielder who was a three-time All-Star. He was literally the closest thing they had to a star. I'm doing the quotes thing with my hand, futurelings, if you can imagine that. In a timely note, Chet Lemon used to not stand up for the national anthem.
Really? What was his reasoning?
Jehovah's Witness.
Are there any Jehovah's Witnesses in the crowd?
Dead silence. Would you like to share with us a short message about what the Bible really says?
I feel like it's entirely possible that everyone in the future is a Jehovah's Witness.
Well, I certainly don't want to offend them then. Good job. Your conversion rate is now 100%. You can stop going to people's houses on Saturday morning.
But that's right. To stand for the Pledge of Allegiance is like a false idol.
Right.
To the
they see it as a kind of idolatry. So he would always sit during the anthem with no
repercussions.
No repercussions whatsoever, because the president was not a wacko, it was Jimmy Carter. 3 weeks after the date our story takes place, the biggest White Sox star enters this story. Their manager was fired, and they called up their AAA guy from the Iowa Oaks, who turned out to be Tony La Russa, who went on to win 3 World Series with the A's and the Cardinals. But in July, when the story takes place, there's no Tony La Russa, there's no nobody. There's just Chet Lemon and a squad of nobodies. Nobody's coming to these games at Comiskey Park.
It's a summer doldrum.
Doldrums, exactly. The perfect summer for the perfect season for doldrums, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Summer. The owner of the White Sox at this time is a guy named Bill Veeck, who's kind of an unusual character. He was the last, like, non-bajillionaire to own a baseball franchise.
Just a regular guy that owned a sausage shop that somehow managed to buy a baseball
team. He won a baseball team, like, in a poker game, like the Millennium Falcon. No, he had worked for a series of sports-related jobs. It was in his family. His dad did something with the Cubs, I guess. But he was just kind of a huckster showman type, you know, in Chicago, in an age when a kind of a big-talking guy like that could just own a baseball franchise with some buddies.
Or start a World's Fair in Seattle.
There you go.
He was exactly the kind of guy my uncle.
He was the Al Rochester of Chicago. And one of his secrets was just crazy promotion. I mean, he would do crazy promotions. Like, if you go to the Mariners... I was there last year on potting soil night, where they gave everybody a big bag of potting soil. They did a sriracha night, which it turns out you can do because sriracha is not a trade name. The little rooster guy is a trade name, but sriracha is just a kind of condiment like ketchup.
But they all were getting T-shirts and stuff, right?
Yeah, but it just said sriracha and it had some colors that no one could sue them over, basically. It was like, hey, licensing-free condiment night at Safeco Field.
A couple of years ago, I went on throwing star night, and that was a really super bad promotion.
This story here is kind of the antecedent of throwing star night. You know, so Bill Veeck would do big bicentennial parades and he would have guys come in dressed as aliens, and he was the one that put the exploding scoreboard in at Comiskey where, you know, it would shoot fireworks off of little Catherine wheels if there was a home run.
He's the one that said that a losing team with bread and circuses attracts more people than a losing team with nothing.
He didn't even make one of them winning? In this analogy, no, they're both losing.
Just two losing teams, one with
take
something else.
Two losing teams. One of them has some firecrackers. He would go so far as to use in-game gimmicks that would actually annoy the commissioner's office. He was the first one in 1951 when he owned the Browns. He hired Max Patkin, this guy who for the next few decades became the clown prince of baseball, to be like a coach in the dugout. Have you ever seen the footage of this guy with the rubber face and the baggy pants? And he's like, whoa, I'm a baseball coach, but I'm not good at it.
This was like a Harlem Globetrotters type of thing.
Exactly.
He'd run out and throw a pail of confetti at
he'd
the pitcher.
Swinging six bats instead of one. And it's funny, because that's five more than the correct number.
Yeah, that is funny.
It's pretty funny.
That translates even to the present day. Did you? Smattering of laughter.
That was actually in the 40s, I think. In the early 50s, he was the one that secretly signed a guy named Eddie Gaedel, who was 3'7" tall, put him in the 9-year-old bat boy's uniform with 1/8 on his back, and had him go out there and draw a walk on 4 straight balls, because when you're 3'7" tall, you're the strike zone, your elbows are so close to your knees, there's essentially no strike zone.
I would go to see that baseball game.
Yeah, even if it was just nothing but walks.
Did he ever, like, put a horse in a baseball uniform? And
the closest thing he did to that was...
As a pinch runner?
He put all the players in shorts in the mid-70s. He was convinced that baseball would be played in shorts in the future. So he tried out a White Sox uniform with shorts.
We don't know that it won't.
Everyone looks so good in a baseball jersey and shorts. That's something I learned every time I go to a game. Dads look great in that outfit.
Every time you go to the supermarket.
And in 1980, this is one of my favorites, he reactivated White Sox legend Mini Mignoso, who was 54 years old, and had him pinch hit in 3 games just so the guy could say he played in 4 consecutive decades. So ways to get people to the ballpark without actually winning or coming close to winning in any way. But, you know, there are some things to his credit. In 1947, for example, he was the manager, he was the owner of the Indians, the president of the Indians, who, a few months after Jackie Robinson desegregated the National League, signed Larry Doby to play in the American League, the first black player in the American League. Always an open-minded guy, by most accounts. He introduced Doby to the team one at a time, watched who would not shake his hand, and then immediately traded or released those 3 guys.
Wow, that's actually, like, I was thinking, well, sure, he signed the first black player in the American League. He's a huckster.
He also got the little person and the bearded woman.
But he actually went down the line and had a mini civil rights litmus test as he went. He's like, you're out, you're out, you're out. That's great.
Yeah, we should have, you know, there's not enough teams do a woke-off in the dugout before every game.
I mean, I feel like we should do that all the time now, just like before you go into the movies.
all public accommodations have to produce a person of color.
You're out.
To see who will not shake their hand, and you can't be in the public sphere.
You're out, nope. Your Seattle citizenship has been revoked, and you have to move to Butte.
I like that idea very much. I like how Butte is your go-to place for racists to live. Sorry, Butte residents.
My mom always said that if God were to give the earth an enema, he would insert it in Butte. My mom is very prejudiced against minors.
And has thought a lot about where to insert an enema in the western United States, something that has never crossed my mind.
No, I don't think she thought a lot about it. I think she just drove through Butte once.
I thought that's what Crater Lake actually was. That was the remnants of the last time an enema had been inserted in the Northwest.
Well, you're taking this and doing some Oregon slander. I like the way you pivoted.
So that brings us to July 12, 1979. Bill Veeck's son, Mike, is in charge of running promotions. And he's been in talks with a local radio station to do what they think is going to be just a killer promotion that's going to bring people, families down to the park.
Does Mike have his father's inspiration, or is he one of these guys that never had any ideas of his own and just sort of following in his father's footsteps?
On tonight's recording, he will be 0-for-1 in the idea department. The White Sox had recently done a disco night playing and celebrating disco music, and a local Chicago DJ, a shock jock, rock station shock jock named Steve Dahl, who was on WLUP, The Loop, 97.9 actually, had contacted the White Sox about doing an anti-disco promotion, equal time. You know, there were equal time laws even then.
So we should say, for a little background, that in the mid-70s, this style of music that sort of started in Europe, in discotheques, in dance clubs, sort of swept the United States. It became a... originally it was a sort of counterculture in the cities, and then with the popularity of the Saturday Night Fever film.
Soundtrack, 1977.
It became incredibly mainstream. It became mainstream in my own house. My mother and sister both, like, loved that record, played it
over. So that's the thing. Like, my memories of disco are not colored by any kind of social or racial quality at all, because I imagine the Bee Gees and ABBA, I imagine kind of fresh-faced white people in hilarious jumpsuits singing this music.
Right, but initially the music
that,
came
Yeah, that
up,
was a gentrified version of disco that I'm remembering.
It came out of the urban clubs. It was a style of music that was... The artists were largely black and Latino.
It came out of R&B and funk, so, right. Much like rock and every other American musical movement in history, it came from black music.
And this mid-70s period was the initial period of gay liberation in the United States, and clubs were sort of organizing places of the gay liberation movement, and so this music was the soundtrack to that as well.
Sure, it was gay culture, it was Latino culture. We know from Saturday Night Fever, it was Italian-American culture, it was African-American culture. It was very urban, but it was everything rock culture in the mid to late 70s was not. Rock had turned into a phenomenon of the heartland, right?
Well, no. Rock was very popular, but this was the era of album-oriented rock, which was no longer a singles-based form of music, right? I mean, there was still AM radio, there were still pop singles, but hard rock, heavy rock, was a thing. Like, famously, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, they couldn't get their songs played on the radio. They were critically derided, but they were selling loads and loads of albums, and people were coming to these stadium shows because they tapped into... I mean, this was also the era of the motorcycle culture, like choppers. It's surprising when you look back to 1977 how popular choppers were. Like, it was a thing like... It's like being a baseball fan, except with choppers.
Except with slightly more choppers.
Yeah, there are no choppers now. I challenge you to find a chopper. But then there's choppers everywhere.
That explains why every picture of a rock band from this period is kind of, starting to age, white men with long hair, facial hair, leather, denim.
They weren't really aging. They were just so addicted to heroin that it was sucking the life out of... the color out of their hair.
That was another gap. Heroin and alcohol and rock, coke and quaaludes on the disco side. There were a ton of the way they dressed, leather and denim versus kind of gold lame and jumpsuits.
And if you like both, you can listen to Blondie.
Right. Blondie was a new wave band that put out a disco single and had a huge hit with it. And they were not the only ones. This is the era when the Rolling Stones realized to stay on the radio, they're going to have to you know, put Miss You on some girls and they're going to have to do hot stuff. They're going to need the beat, right? So they appropriate the beat. Rod Stewart becomes a disco artist. Kiss puts a disco beat on I Was Made for Loving You.
They sure did.
Paul McCartney thinks that Wings will be back if he puts a disco beat on Goodnight Tonight.
Well, and this happened with reggae music. Do you remember? It was sort of in a similar time. Eric Clapton put out a reggae song. The Pretenders had a couple of reggae tunes on their first record. The Police were essentially a reggae band. I mean, there was a lot of co-op.
The Clash, you know, were as much of a reggae band as The Police.
Well, so here we get into where people are going to boo me, but yes, The Clash are a reggae band.
They're
a
reggae
band.
Don't get me wrong. They're my favorite white reggae band. They're the only white reggae band that matters.
No, that's wrong. The best white reggae band is The Pretenders.
Oh,
no, their two reggae songs are terrible.
So a lot of white rock artists were incorporating this stuff into their music, even though it was really not along the lines of kind of a white guy with lead guitar singing very soulful, male, earnest things. That could not have been more different than kind of the less party, dance-friendly, what a rockist would have seen as trivial and synthetic qualities of incredibly listenable disco music.
What's wonderful about the 1970s, and I don't know if any of you are older than 27, but those of you who are older than 27 will remember there was a period in the 80s and 90s where the 70s were thought of as this dark period in music where everything was terrible.
They were wearing bell bottoms, can you believe it?
But now we can look back and realize that that was in some ways the richest period of American pop music, because there were, I mean, this was the era. Like, yeah, disco on the radio, yacht rock, there was the stadium rock, there were folky ballads. I have the list of the top 100 singles of 1979,
and
it is hilarious. The way
is it like disco, 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 Doobie Brothers, disco, disco, disco?
Doobie Brothers and Dr. Hook, and then and then all of a sudden, like, Foreigner arrives on the scene. The biggest record of 1979 was The Knack.
Ah.
That was the number one record of the year.
Was it My Sharona?
My Sharona. Yeah. And that introduced New Wave to the popular culture, right? The Knack.
Right. But there was an element in which this kind of rock snobbery about disco looked like artistic snobbery, although now we can look back and see that all these disco songs were incredibly great. But to them, they were kind of blind to whatever the racial or homophobic or even misogynistic elements might have been. You know, rock was where guys sang about their soulful concerns. But if you wanted to hear Donna Summer sing about what it was like to be a woman in 1979, disco was the main outlet for that.
It wasn't really their soulful concerns that guys were singing about it as much as it was Satan, Satan, Satan.
You're saying disco is God's music and rock is Satan's music? Is that the divide you have in mind?
Disco is God's music, but this was, you know.
No, heaven will almost certainly have disco. Think of it, the gold lamé, the swirling lights. I mean, disco club is as close as you were going to get to a kind of a heavenly vibe.
If you look at the cover of the Bee Gees' Spirits Having Flown, they are truly in heavenly garb, right? They're in soft focus with halos.
Think about ABBA in their white, sparkling jumpsuits. Imagine just dying in a plane crash and then Bjorn and Benny and, you know, ABBA is there to welcome you wearing that garb. You would know where you were.
I would for sure. As opposed to, like, if Ozzy was there, you'd be like, oh!
Is this heaven? No, it's Sweden. And this kind of, you know, this kind of conflict, you know, rockism versus poptimism is a kind of a battle that continues today, even though, you know, I was born in what I would have thought was the post-disco era. Like, when I was first aware of what music was on the Hot 100 that me and all my friends were listening to, it was the same year that Thriller came out. And here we have a Motown artist who came from a disco band who is just indisputably better than any guitar band on earth, a better musician, you know, better live act. Just disco was not great live, but Michael sure was. And the argument seemed to be over. Even if disco was still a punchline, we had lived in the world it had created, and rock was now runner-up.
We decided that we could not use the word disco, partly as a result, you could make an argument as a result of this event that we're discussing.
And Rick D's novelty songs and Disco Duck.
Right.
And yeah.
I don't know, by applause, how many people had Sesame Street Disco in their house?
We had Sesame Street Disco.
Yeah, Sesame Street Disco. That was a great album. Doing the Pigeon, Rubber Ducky, You're the One. C is for Cookie.
Even the Henson Workshop fell under the spell of the disco beat.
These were great tracks.
The thumping spell.
But it's true that, I mean, this is, now we think of a red-blue divide in the United States as being something that's really, like, culturally it's hardening, and it's in some ways hardened off. But at this point in time, we didn't really see America that way. But there was, this was the beginning of a kind of cultural separation between, you said before, like blue-collar white dudes. But, I mean, it was more universal than that, certainly. But it was a contrast between the culture of concentrated urban centers that were very diverse and rural, not rural, but suburban America. And it didn't yet have a religious connotation like it does now. There wasn't, like, traditional values.
Although if there had been, people would have been like, what's with the village people's costumes?
Sure, but also traditional values are not exactly like best described by Black Sabbath, right? Those aren't the traditional values that we think of now. So, I mean, it was a period where
Lawrence Welk was still on the air for those people.
Lawrence Welk was on the air, but also like they were selling bongs in Playboy magazine. This is the era of when Playboy would be on people's coffee tables who were normal Americans, maybe not any of your grandparents, but there were, you know, it was like you could read a Playboy on an airplane. I remember sitting next to a guy as a kid who was just reading the articles.
And when you talk about the culture war element of it, I remembered that as a kid, we had some, I don't know where we had gotten this, maybe it was at my grandparents' house, but just some book about the dangers of modern music. And really what this focused on from a you know, religious, cultural point of view was the dangers of the thudding beat in so much modern music. Because rock had kind of buried the beat in the 70s. You could not dance to a Led Zeppelin record.
Led Zeppelin, a lot of rock became very artistic, and it was, there were unusual time signatures. It didn't have that.
It's all Prague's fault.
And, you know, in the 1960s, if you listen to a 1960s pop recording, often the loudest instrument by far is the tambourine. Like, it is. To put on any Motown record, and it's like, and then, like, somewhere in there, there's a band.
But this book kind of had the default Southern Baptist point of view in the 70s and 80s, which was that this kind of thudding beat were, and it's incredibly racist, were jungle rhythms.
Right. That started in the 50s.
It's the same
right?
stuff we said about rock. And that's the funny thing, because in those days, the album burnings were against rock. You know, rock was not yet the default music. Once rock became what we thought of as, you know, the default alternative in the pre-hip-hop era.
It's hard to imagine now in the time of Christian nu metal bands, right? I mean, every single megachurch has some band up there that's like, Jesus! And that's, you know, considering that those were taboo rhythms until the 90s, really.
Right. And it's funny, I think, that these rock, you know, these edgy rock guys would kind of ally themselves with the burners of art. Because historically, that's not the side you want to be on, right?
I don't think the rock guys did. I think, you know, like shock jock DJs.
Sure. When I say rock guys, I mean guys like Steve Dahl, who actually had lost his job when his previous station went disco.
See,
like there was a business component here.
That'll
for
turn a person against against disco music if your station goes disco. And he was sitting there with his big sideburns like, what?
But it's an early example of this Trump era phenomenon where this guy's just doing some self-serving thing for his bottom line, and he angries up a bunch of yokels who are like, yeah, I'll bring my Motown records to a baseball game and blow them up.
So what was the stunt?
The stunt was, you know, Steve Dahl's radio station being 98, you know, 97.9, Loop 98. You would get in for 98 cents to this game if you brought your disco records. And again, ushers at the time noticed that people were not being super strict about the definition of disco. It was really just...
And you weren't bringing your disco records so they would play them.
That's right. They were going to do requests all night.
They had little stereos set up all around the baseball stadium. People were like, my turn.
This was a twi-night doubleheader against the Tigers to make up for a previous rainout. The White Sox, again, were lackluster 40-46 in July. They were going to, between the games, put all the disco records that people had brought into a big crate in center field and blow it up. Steve Dahl led, every morning on the radio, he led his anti-disco army, and he would play a few seconds of a disco record and then scratch the needle all across it.
Oh, and take people, that, disco.
People would cheer at what we were doing to this force that was threatening our rock.
This was only 15 years after they were burning Beatles records.
Well, sure.
John Lennon said that they were bigger than
Jesus. They were going to be bigger than Jesus. And again, like, why would you want to be the guy burning art? You know, historically, that's either an invader, that's Rome sacking Alexandria, or the conquistadors burning the Aztec codices, or the British burning the Library of Congress, or it's an oppressor. It's Savonarola in Florence burning all the Renaissance art. It's Nazis burning whatever they call decadent art. Ancient China in 200 BC, they would actually burn edgy scrolls, and then they would bury the scholars alive.
Really?
Which is really, when you think about it, more effective, because they can't make new scrolls.
I can't think of a better description.
Like, Donna Summer can still make a record, even if they blow up a few of them in Chicago. But
I can't think of a better descriptive term for the Omnibus Project than edgy scroll.
I do hope we exist in parchment form in the future. Well, but unburnable.
Well, I think, you know, people because this DJ was encouraging his listeners to become a kind of
cult,
an army, like, we're against disco, right? Like, fire up your El Camino and come to town and let's cause some trouble. And, you know, that's just any demagogue, right? All you need is an excuse if it's that rock is better than disco, or if it's that we need a bigger wall on the border.
It probably has to tap into something. But you're right. It doesn't have to be a pre-existing. People didn't have to be getting up being like, when is someone going to speak out against Gloria Gaynor?
Right. But I mean, it's much easier to posit your Supertramp record against like a Donna Summer record. Think of the tinfoil hats that are like, Sandy Hook was fake. Like, and there are tens of thousands of people that are living in that reality. So it's easy to demagogue people if they're not, if all the news they're getting is from Cream Magazine.
So,
sorry for that reference. That was super old dude reference.
So Mike Vec and Steve Dahl are hoping they'll get more than the usual 15,000 people who have been coming to games at Comiskey. They're surprised to see 50,000 people showing up. It's a sellout. And even once they close the gates, more people are sneaking in because they're so eager to be at what is turning into a kind of a happening.
20,000 more people in the streets, I read. 50,000 in the stadium and 20,000 outside clamoring to get in.
So many clamoring to get in, the extra security is sent to the gates to keep them out, which will become important later in our story. concessions are being openly stolen. Like, nobody can sell beer because beer is just disappearing as fast as they can put it out. Everybody over 40 is noticing the strong smell of pot wafting through the stadium.
If you want to think about how threatened the rock people felt, here's the top records of 1979. The top one, as I said, the Knack. Because My Sharona is the greatest record.
It's the catchiest record ever made.
Although the bridge is terrible. I'm sorry. Don't at me. But then we go Donna Summer, Chic, Rod Stewart's Do You Think I'm Sexy, his crossover disco.
Appropriation.
The anomalous Peaches and Herb reunited record.
Feels so good.
Which is a real panty dropper. And then Gloria Gaynor, Donna Summer, Village People, Anita Ward's Ring My Bell.
Ring my bell.
So, there's Donna Summer's cover of MacArthur Park. Try that on for size. Bee Gees. I mean, the first rock record is all the way down at number 19, the Doobie Brothers' What a Fool Believes.
And even What a Fool Believes is kind of disco.
It is a little disco.
Like,
so
that's like Eagles One of These Nights. That's some band being like, are we going to chart if we don't have a little beat on this thing?
There's Billy Joel, I guess, is at 28. So there's, you know, the people who felt like this was part of a culture war had a lot of evidence that everywhere they turned, something was going.
So everybody brings in their disco records and they're supposed to surrender them, but not all do apparently, because during the first game, which the White Sox lose to the Tigers 4-1, records are being hurled at players. And it's funny, but every time I see interviews about this, it's always the black and Latino players who are getting records thrown at them, and you kind of wonder, hey, I wonder if these people had targets in mind.
Can you imagine how lethal a fully sleeved vinyl album thrown from the top deck of a baseball stadium would be?
Sure, or what if you unsleeve it? It's throwing star night if you unsleeve it, you know? Between the games, Steve Dahl drives out there in a Jeep wearing kind of a fake military fatigues type uniform of his anti-disco army.
And a helmet.
And a helmet, yeah. He looks like a motorcycle guy.
He's Patton. Oh, right. He looks like motorcycle guy in the Village People.
Do you think he knew?
I doubt he thought so.
And he announces to the crowd that this is no longer a baseball game. It's now officially the world's largest anti-disco rally. And he gets some chant of disco sucks going. He shows them the crate that's been wheeled out to center field and says, we're going to blow them up real good. At which point they do, and they may have miscalibrated the amount of explosives you would need at a baseball game. There's probably not a lot of data here because they leave a huge crater in center field.
It's like the time that Keith Moon staged a little explosive in his kick drum when the Who played on the Smothers Brothers, and he hit the explosive, and it was like a pipe bomb.
It killed eight people. There used to be 10 Smothers Brothers.
Well, there were 10 guys in the Who, but unfortunately, Pete Townsend happened to be like bending down in front of the drums, and he said he never regained hearing in that.
Oh, that was it.
Yeah,
that's why Pete can't hear.
That bomb.
Wow. I don't know if anyone was deafened by this, but it was a lot bigger than people were thinking. And when they tried to clear he takes off in his Jeep, and the Tigers pitcher even comes out to warm up for game two. But that's when the fans start realizing that all the security is at the gates. No one's between them and the field. They're all pretty, they're nicely beard and weeded up at this point. And people just start hopping over the fence so they can run the bases or hang out or see the crater or whatever. And once you get to a tipping point of enough disco-hating young people out there, everybody starts running onto the field and doing exactly what they want to do. So what it gets to is massive throngs of people everywhere. Fires are lit in the stands and in the outfield.
Wow, this sounds amazing.
You got a guy shinning up the foul pole and then sliding down. Big camera rigs getting tossed over. Home plate is dug up. So, the bases have literally been stolen. Kids are actually getting to third base behind third base, if you know what I mean. And you don't want to play on that afterwards. And the White Sox try to regain order. Harry Carey was then with the White Sox, and he gets up there. Holy cow, what's happened? Let's sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and then we'll all take our seats again. And it does not work. The stadium has a nice, polite, please return to your seats, and that does not trouble anyone at all.
You never went, I don't think, to a stadium metal concert in the early 80s, but this is what they were all like.
So that there was an expectation that, of course, this is what we do when we go to a stadium.
Yeah, let's go. Like, let's start a fire.
Would people actually steal home plate?
There were no home plates typically at a Judas Priest concert, unless you brought the one from the Disco Sucks riot.
Plenty of third base, I hear, but no home plates. 45 minutes later, the police are finally called, and they come in full riot gear because it's now a full-fledged riot on horses and make 39 arrests. And people gradually kind of, the purge ends, that everybody's mind clears. Maybe they put on some Credence or something, and people are like, whoa.
This is the America that they talk about when they say make America great again. This is it.
More riots between twi-night doubleheader games. That's what I want to see. It's not as good an acronym, right? MRBTNDHG. Doesn't fit on a red hat. The White Sox want to play, but the field is full of broken glass. There's puddles of beer. The ground crew is up there trying to clean up whatever bodily fluids they can. But Sparky Anderson of the Tigers is PO'd, and he says his boys will not play no matter what.
He saw an opportunity here to get this game forfeited.
Because guess what? It's a win. And the next day, the commissioner's office announces it was indeed a forfeit, which means that the Tigers win with what score? Do you guys know this?
9-0.
9-0. It's one of my favorite things about baseball is how punitive forfeits are. You lost every inning. You deserve to forfeit every single one of those innings. And in fact, 1979, that was the last forfeit in American League history. We've made it through 30 years without a subsequent rock-powered riot.
Time to set off some kind of bomb in the middle of center field at a Mariners game.
Nope, John did not suggest that. I'm sure glad.
Oh, that's right, no shush. Well, the people listening to this show are like 7,000 years in the future.
Right, but the Mariners, and even 7,000 years in the future, the Mariners are still well below 500 going into September.
It's a baseball team entirely of Cthulhus, and they still can't score a run.
Yeah, because all the other teams have just as many tentacles, so it's just as hard to hit a fly ball. So 50,000 to 70,000 people is still believed to be the largest crowd in White Sox history to this day.
And incredibly, although this was a debacle, and people even in its time recognized the racial and homophobic overtones of it. I mean, there was quite a bit of critical appraisal of it even then as a kind of weird and ugly cultural moment. It also presaged what became a nationwide disaffection with disco music.
It may have accelerated the nationwide disaffection. Certainly the disco bubble popped immediately in late 1979 through 1980. And that happens to musical movements from time to time. So I don't know if we can say an alternate history where they just do Potting Soil Night on July 29th. And disco is still super popular and, you know, Nile Rodgers is president right now. I don't know if that is actually true.
But interestingly, when this event happened, the number one record in the country was Bad Girls by Donna Summer, which is an incredible album, by the way. And then immediately afterward, The Knack got to the top of the charts. And then for the rest of the year, there were only two records at the top of the charts. In Through the Outdoor, the final Zeppelin record, and maybe its first appearance on the top of the charts, and then The Long Run by the Eagles.
So that was the end result of Disco Demolition Night. Eagles got back to number one.
This is what America decided was, I mean, this is their nine runs scored in a game. They're like, oh, you don't like disco? Try The Long Run. And that concludes Disco Demolition Night. Entry 356.AC1919, certificate number 25815.
In the omnibus.
Yep.
John's never actually done this show.
Certificate number 25815, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, our tweets are archived at Omnibus Project. And our Twitter handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. Please do not allow social media to exist in your era. If it does, it is one more failing of our time that we have not eliminated it completely. You can go to my Instagram page, at John Roderick, where I take pictures of every meal I have. And the rest of the time, there are blurry pictures of my dog in bed with me.
If the future is interested in watching a man separate different bolts and screws into different coffee mugs, mm-hmm. that would be the Instagram account for them.
Often I'll go a whole week where it's just my progress as I sort rusty bolts.
You think
I'm kidding.
You got to document this stuff.
I would like to recommend that if you are on Facebook, that you get off of it immediately. But if you insist on being there, you should go to our Futurelings Facebook page, where a lot of smart people are talking about smart things, and it's very funny, but it is not a dating site.
No.
Do not use it as such.
It's all very chaste.
You can email us at omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com, and if you want to send us physical objects, you may mail them through the mists of time at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Listeners, we speak to you from the post-disco distant past. We have no idea how long our post-disco civilization will survive before we all arrive at ABBA heaven together.
Disco's back, so it may prolong our suffering.
Maybe we'll have ABBA disco heaven here on Earth. It's the second coming of ABBA.
Let's start,
Swedish figures descend from the clouds.
Let's start it immediately. When our theme music plays at the end, I want everybody out of their seats.
We hope and pray that this catastrophe that precipitates this return will never come. But if the worst comes soon, this very recording could be our final word to you. But we certainly hope the providence will allow us to be back with you soon for another entry in the omnibus. They're not dancing.
Wait for the beat to drop.
We're going to do a little Q&A if anybody has questions for us. We still have a few minutes that we left at the end.
Yeah, we saved some time in case you have questions. This is only our second public appearance. Ken never leaves his readout, and I'm deep in my bunker.
Our second public appearance as a podcast.
Yeah, you were on TV for 75 consecutive... I know you like me to mention it every time.
Right.
75 consecutive episodes of Jeopardy.
And John left the house last night and got burgers at University Village.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I did go to University Village. I got a stuffed pizza. The real kind of pizza, Chicago-style stuffed pizza. Wow, I got one woo. Normally I just get hissed out of the room. All right, so this is a children's theater, so we will be able to hear you if you just shout out your question. Does anyone have a question? Yes.
Did you ever get to see Ken Griffey Jr., The Kingdom?
I did. Did you?
I did.
Yeah.
Many times. I saw Griffey Jr. and Griffey Sr. in the same lineup at The Kingdom, which was exciting. That was only one season.
Yeah, that was nice. My dad and I, the last thing I went to in The Kingdom, my dad and I went to see a...
Black Sabbath show.
No, a game. No. We went to see the Seahawks play against Wisconsin, the Green Bay Packers.
They played a collegiate team.
University of Wisconsin.
The Seahawks were so bad, they lost to the University of Wisconsin.
No, they played the Packers, and there were so many Packers fans that had come in RVs, and they were all wearing their cheesehead hats. And the stadium, and it was a middle-of-the-day game with two teams that weren't like in the contention, and yet there were 40,000 people there. And I realized then that the biggest rock concert in the world at the time couldn't get 40,000 people to a thing, and there were this many people here to watch this dumb sports game, and I realized I had chosen wrong.
And yet baseball still claims to be the national pastime.
Another question.
There, maybe? I don't know. Are we pointing to different people? Yes.
No, I think you're pointing to the same person. You, in the plaid shirt.
Awesome. So I was just curious about process in terms of picking topics. And also, do you guys have a list? And if so, how long is it?
Ken was just looking at his list. He and I both spend a lot of time just thinking about all kinds of this dumb stuff, like presumably we all do. And the reason we started the show, you know, when we initially conceived of the show, it was we tried to come up with an idea that would appeal to people. And so we had
I wanted something that would not constrain us at all.
Yeah.
You know, whatever I thought was interesting, I could just talk about that because that's the best kind of white privilege. Something just occurred to me. I feel I should talk about it for an hour. This is what the world needs, me, a white guy, talking about something I thought of once.
But our initial idea was we'd have a show called The Worst, which was a show where we were going to pick the worst thing in every kind of thing we could think of.
Just the stories of famous failures and bloopers and whatnot.
Yeah, which is basically what we are doing. It's just we don't characterize it that way. But we were on an airplane to Atlanta together. We're sitting next to each other. Every stewardess came by and wanted a picture with Ken because that's right in his demographic.
That's not a thing. Like,
we were sitting there and we were like thinking up ideas for the worst, and when there was some silence went by. And then I said, do you like this idea? And Ken was like, no, not really. And I was like, let's not do this show, The Worst. That seems like a bummer.
It seemed like the only upside was every show we could be like, I'm Ken and I'm John, and this show is the worst.
Yeah, right.
It's like we were on Nickelodeon in the 90s.
But then immediately we were like, let's do a show that fits with us. And we were like, well, and immediately we picked a name that 90% of the American people won't know what it means. And we started like brainstorming ideas that were just exactly the kind of show we do. So the research we do is largely just driven by our own.
I looked at the list on my phone. I have about 80 ideas, including Ted Danson in blackface. So I can't wait for that one. But yeah, it really is. It's not. People do send us ideas, but this is mostly just me thinking about something weird or reading something weird and being like, I bet there's a show.
Well, you know, and I've been trying. I wanted to do The Church of the Subgenius. But it's taken me like 8 months to even learn enough about the Church of the Sub. I mean, I've lived with it my whole life, and I still don't understand it.
You're just sketching
the
contours.
Like, one of these days, I'm going to have enough for a show. Any other questions?
I feel like there was a hand in this general area. Oh, it was Ari.
That's actually Marla's, your 7-year-old daughter's question.
My 7-year-old daughter cannot be at a show without making herself the center of it. So
Can't you ask him at home, Marlo?
Where'd she get that from?
What's your question, darling? Shout it out. Don't have your mother as a proxy.
What's your favorite podcast?
My favorite podcast?
The favorite one that you did.
Oh, the favorite one that we did.
Oh, favorite episode of this show, Marlo?
That's a really good question, Marlo.
I had a neighbor ask me that last night. He was leaving, and I hear you have a podcast. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, what's it rated? It's like, I don't know, like PG at best, I guess.
No, every podcast is rated 4.5 stars, right? I mean, it's like the rating system is totally meaningless.
But his second question was, if you could listen to any one episode, what should I start with? And I did not have a good answer.
Yeah, that's a super good question, Marlo. I mean, Ken and I both bring different topics to the show, right? And a lot of the time, Ken's ideas are ones that are new to me, and I learn a lot.
Vice versa.
And so it would be hard to pick. You know, it's what ends up happening is when he leads a show like tonight, he has a bunch of facts, and I am sort of learning about it.
You had the whole Hot 100 for 1979.
Yeah, you did some homework. I was really playing solitaire. I just had that memorized. And then when I have the idea, right, I have all the facts, and Ken is learning about it. So it's a dynamic that I guess it's interesting every time. You don't have a single episode you can point to?
I ended up recommending to my neighbor Boysenberries because he was a guy who had just asked what it's rated.
Right.
And that's kind of a show about classic Americana, fruit and summer fruit stands and theme parks, California in the 60s.
I mean, the second show we ever did was about the defenestrations of Prague. And that may still be one of my favorites just because I got to talk about the defenestrations of Prague, and I can't do that at home.
You can't?
No, no one wants to hear it. Oh, I get stopped right away. And that's true when I try and talk about it on buses, too. People are like, let me stop you there. Anyone else? Yes.
Have you noticed any of the ideas that you've talked about over the course of the series thus far, or the ideas that you've been researching, do any of common architects or common themes or common people or anything that you notice that may link these sort of inane and
Hey.
You know, and this is something that we have never like spoken of openly, but every one of these things roughly like suggests a kind of future apocalypse. Every one of these is a tiny little element that kind of takes us closer to the fall of civilization.
On John's InfoWars chalkboard at home.
So, so the idea is always like, these are not just like crazy bloopers or Ken's amazing trivia facts and bloopers.
And fun.
They're all little elements where things have gone awry. Either, you know, like events in history or ideas or places. Where things, you know, events like this one where you're like, huh, is that, can we look back at that and see
how we got to this moment?
That it foreshadowed where we are. Because the initial idea was this is a time capsule that will be preserved after the apocalypse. And so, you know, we're kind of walking people up to it. Well, we've never said that out loud, but.
Also, World's Fairs have come up a lot and that's right. Nazis.
I will bring up the Nazis. If you let any silence go by. And in this episode, we didn't bring it up until now.
And yeah, this whole podcast is mostly me just trying to keep talking, so John just doesn't say, when Hermann Göring took over the Luftwaffe.
Anyone else? Surely there are some questions.
You have 4 minutes left before they usher us out.
Anyone want to ask Ken a question about his Jeopardy
run? Does
anyone
want to ask John a question about 90s indie rock?
Yes, my sister. Let's go. What really front-loaded the audience here.
I was just wondering how much of it is off the cuff and how much is prepared as far as the back and forth, or is it all off the cuff?
None of the back and forth is prepared. We don't.
As is usually evident. Yeah.
I mean, when Ken has a topic, he usually sends it to me at 11 o'clock the night before. And then I, you know, lay in bed with my phone and start to think about it. But generally, like, we know the basic ideas of everything. We're, you know, we don't have to, it's very unusual that one of us will send the other a topic where we don't have some familiarity with it.
Like, right? you don't have to Google it to know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time, Ken will send me something and I'll say, wow, great idea, right? Because we already, like, have a basis in it. I don't tell Ken my topic until he's sitting in front of a microphone.
Typically after we usually do 2 shows in a day, and after we do my show, I'll be like, John, what are we doing now? Like, tell me your topic.
And then I say something like, wow, I don't know, Hitler?
He's like, no! Hitler's dog, no! We can't do Hitler's dog every show, John.
But if you look at our shows, Tuesday shows are ones that are led by Ken, and Thursday shows are led by me. And I think you start to see a through line of our different interests and just our different kind of like worldview.
Yeah, I'm most aware when it's something I don't know much about. Like your expertise about hardware of all kinds, not just military hardware, but also guitars and
cars,
20th century cars, and you know stuff like that. Where I don't feel like I have any expertise, that's when I have to do some Googling.
And Ken likes to do things that he doesn't know anything about, like math.
Oh, yeah. Like, John has never done a theoretical math episode.
No, and Ken's always like, oh, let's talk about, 11-dimensional math. And I'm like, do you know anything about that? And he's like, not really.
That's a great way to sell the show to people, by the way. Hey, listen to this podcast about 11-dimensional math.
This is the end, not the beginning, so. Yes. Yes.
Maybe this is well established, but how did you two meet and then presumably like each other enough to want to talk to each other for a half hour at a time?
We met at Bumbershoot.
Not this year. We met at a brunch, right?
Yeah.
John Hodgman was in town, and he got invited. He's a friend of John's, and he got invited to a brunch that I was at, and I was chatting with him, and then I chatted with you at the last minute. We were kind of on our way out.
This was a brunch at Maria Semple and George Meyer's apartment, which is just a few blocks away. Maria Semple of...
Beloved Seattle Wright, a literary power couple.
Where'd You Go, Bernadette, and George Meyer of The Simpsons.
Right. And
who are married to one another.
They're actually not.
Oh, they're not married.
They're boyfriend, girlfriend.
All right. Okay, sorry.
But they've been together for decades.
It's really hard to tell.
And so we chatted briefly. I was on my way into the party as you were on your way out.
I knew of Ken from the time in American culture where he was ubiquitous. Do you remember that when they were writing about him in the newspaper? Like, can you believe this guy? Like, he looks exactly like you would think.
This good. I got it. I woke up like this, John.
And Ken, surprisingly, you wouldn't know it. It wouldn't be suggested by your Jeopardy run, but he also knows a ton about rock and roll and bands and culture, film, et cetera, et cetera. So he was, unfortunately, not familiar with my band, but he went immediately and listened to all the albums and then became a super fan.
I had heard your band on, KXP, but I was not, it's true that I was not a fan with the albums.
And then from that point on, every time we saw each other, he would sit in my lap and take a selfie.
I really liked John's professorial air, and a few months later, I called him to see if he would be in a book video for me. I just wanted him to have a white jacket and a clipboard and be a fake scientist, which I didn't know was kind of his main skill set, I guess, is looking like a fake scientist. And we've been friends ever since.
So that is the end of our time. Thank you very much for listening to the Omnibus Project and for coming to see our show.
Enjoy the rest of Bumbershoot, you guys. Give it up for John Roderick.
America's sweetheart, Ken Jennings.